The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Hugh Muir. The economic crisis that hit Europe and America in 2008 took almost everyone by surprise. Yet once it was underway, it seemed to have so many obvious causes as to be inevitable. Housing bubbles, mispriced risk, slumbering regulators, credulous journalists, pliant politicians. Banks defaulted, but there was a wider crisis too. The foundations of Western economics suddenly seemed to be subsiding. Now, having followed that crisis up close, Channel 4's economics editor, Faisal Islam, has put pen to paper. And the result is an in-depth look at the crash, a new book called The Default Line. Well, Faisal Islam's been talking to us. The Observer's Julian Komen interviewed him. And he began by asking about a so-called journalistic default. How did the media fail to spot the crash coming?
I guess if you take a step back, I mean, this is part of a broader picture of our relationship to finance and the housing market as well. Journalism was probably a force for, well, definitely was a force for pro-cyclicality, kind of helping build up the bubble at its kind of most extreme ebb, and then probably aiding the despondency on the way down too. I think of myself, like, if I had a time machine and we could go back and we could unpick what went wrong and when it went wrong, why weren't the hacks, the journalists, asking these sorts of questions at the time? Because that would have been a profoundly important role for journalism, because the frame that we paint on the economy and on society is the one that politicians have to act within. It's a very important kind of incentive structure for politicians. And on the one level, obviously, journalists get carried away with the exuberance. But if you take that approach, you do see that, you know, a couple of things. You see that many of the problems were kind of purposefully wrapped in a layer of complexity that made them quite difficult to disentangle. Journalistically, it made it very difficult for regulators and for politicians to disentangle.
Absolutely,
But there are bigger currents in the world that impact everybody's everyday living standards. And they stretch from a migrant worker in China, who I met and followed, from the fields to a factory, and how that impacted upon people's living standards here, all the way to, if you're Spanish, the decisions of a German banker being asked by a senior diplomat, you know, why are you lending so much money to Spain? And they say, well, the German banker says, you need to go to the disco and dance near the door, which kind of so perfectly and accurately describes the German approach to not lending any money domestically, essentially, to its own mortgage market because no one wanted it, but then fanning out huge savings glut from Germany into subprime in America and into Spain. So I guess that there are, you know, if you want to know, I put it like this, you know, many people are obsessing about the sourcing of their milk and their beef burgers, hoping that their beef. If you think about what impacts upon your wages, the amount of credit in the economy, the value of your house, the how much rent you're likely to pay, whether or not you're going to stay in your job and how secure that job is, if you look at the kind of supply chain of these types of things, there are many factors which nobody was writing about at the time. So there was a journalistic default. And part of this is trying to kind of, if you like, make up for that. A number of journalists and economists claim great prophecies for what was going on. Not hugely convinced about that at the time. Actually, in 2003, for The Observer, when I was here, I did write a series of pieces about how it was impossible for house prices to go up from this stage. And lots of other economists were saying the same thing. And they did. They doubled again in the next 5 years.
Apparently,
which lost me a lot of friends.
Apparently defying logic, and actually defying logic, as it turned out.
Yeah,
in the end.
But the answers lay in the murky corners of the shadow banking system, though nobody even called it the shadow banking system at the time. So one might argue there's a bit of 2020 hindsight, but that's really important. And in any event, I think going back over what went wrong is the surest kind of, well, it's the most important factor in determining what to make right. You know, I think one of the key lessons I would say is it's very easy to bash bankers, and there's much to bash bankers about, but actually, if you look at what's going on in the Eurozone and in Britain, we're living through the consequences of decisions made 10 years ago. And the decisions being made now will have consequences for people in 10 years. I mean, how do we hold that stuff to account?
So I'd like to talk about those future decisions, particularly with regard to the Eurozone. But just before doing that, you start the book with Greece, and Greece was, if you like, the victim par excellence of a structure that had been set up, namely the euro currency, without fiscal union, without a system for transfer between countries. The result was close to a complete catastrophe in Greece, wasn't it? And you have some incredibly detailed information about just how close Greece got to simply running out of money.
Yeah, so the phrase running out of money is often used metaphorically by journalists and by economists. I think what's quite intriguing in Greece, they literally did nearly run out of banknotes. There's one intriguing anecdote here, but it tells you a lot about how the Eurozone is run. They have a printing press in Greece, but they only got given the plates, or they only had the plates at the time of fairly extensive but kind of controlled bank runs in 2011 and 2012. They only had the plates for the 10 euro note, so they could only print 10 euros. Only German-speaking countries have ever had the plates for the 500 euro note, which is the highest value banknote in the world. That might be coincidence. Who knows? But at the time, in 2011 and in 2012, such was the demand for banknotes. And in Greece, you would go to a bank and you'd say, I want 100,000 euros. And then they would phone up the central bank and you'd order the notes and you'd get it the next day. So, you know, there was some control over this. But the Central Bank of Greece quite quickly had to amass a huge stock of notes just to fulfil demand for banknotes in that country. I'll give you a statistic. Mm. Typically, developed countries have, as a percentage of their national economy, about 3, 4, 5% of GDP in the actual value of banknotes. You might think that that's quite low. Greece had about 7 or 8% in 2009, I think it was. Uh-huh. By 2012, it was 25%. That's, I think, more than most developing countries. So it was full of cash because people only believed in cash and they were hiding it under their mattresses. They were using up all the safe deposit boxes. Mm. They were taking it abroad and buying property in Britain, for example. But they physically needed that cash. And there was an astonishing logistical operation to get the euro notes air freighted over secretly without telling anyone to stop any panic. And two very well-placed informants have told me that included at some stages military planes from Rome. And so I liken this to a kind of the Athens airlift. And if you want to know what would have happened in the absence of this, you only have to go to Cyprus 4 or 5 months ago, where there was for about a week a doubt that these types of notes would be delivered. And lo and behold, I actually physically saw the cargo planes that were bringing in the euros. So it's a kind of like unique airline, Air Force Euro.
Air Force fiscal emergency.
Keeping the Eurozone afloat. And this is not just a kind of intriguing anecdote, a bit of ephemeral detail. It's actually quite important because if you think about it, if you're in a monetary union, this is the symbol of your lack of sovereignty. Because traditionally, you have your own printing press.
As in Britain, and if
push comes to shove, you can press print, and the value of your currency will be devalued, but you can also always fund what it is that you owe the world markets. Mm. If you're in a monetary union, that plane is your printing press. And that plane's air traffic control is in Frankfurt, run by a guy now called Mario Draghi, previously by a French guy called Jean-Claude Trichet. And it just shows you very visibly, physically, if you like, the loss of sovereignty entailed within the monetary union.
And of course, what the Greece's difficulty was precisely that it couldn't perform that kind of internal devaluation. There was simply no means of doing that and remaining inside the euro. And so what it was essentially obliged to do was cut living standards in a way that we've never seen before in such a deliberate fashion in a Western European country, certainly post-Second World War. That was obviously a hugely unhappy outcome of a currency which was set up in what I think even those pro-Euro commentators of the late 1990s in Britain would now recognise that it was set up in a flawed way. Mm. Where do you see the future post this near catastrophe going in terms of the Eurozone and the fiscal union that it needs, the other systems and mechanisms that it needs to kind of avert this kind of catastrophe.
So they did avert the catastrophe, though. That's quite important. And I think having had some access to some people at the top of the decision-making apparatus in the countries that matter and in the European sort of monetary sort of regime, I'm pretty clear that the Eurozone is going to survive. Whether it survives with all the same countries in it is another matter. There may be a decision to be made, firstly, for Cyprus. There may even be a decision to be made by the people of Greece. But they seem quite adamant to push that decision, you know, to say to the people of Cyprus and Greece in the first instance, you choose. It's kind of like a economic cardiac arrest outside the Eurozone system or prolonged chronic pain within. I think just take a step back, if you like, there's two big lies at the moment under sort of underpinning the Eurozone in political economy terms, which they've surely got to get right to get this system working. The first lie is the one you refer to, which is about cuts to living standards and cuts to wages. Essentially, if you're in Greece, Portugal, Ireland, Spain, Italy, accept lower wages. That is the message.
Worse pensions and across the board.
Yeah. But the argument would be, or the argument that's made, is that this is that there is a hill and they're coming down the other end of the hill, if you see what I mean. In that this was built up unsustainably in the first place, and you're, if you're like, just unwinding some of that excess. It's quite remarkable to go to places in Germany and see economists and government-linked economists, and they pull out these graphs showing how inefficient, I mean, they know, they've memorised, it's called the unit labour cost graph, they've memorised how inefficient Greece is. They feel hurt and sometimes anger and upset that Ireland's average living standards, I think they still are just about higher, or they certainly were higher than Germany's. But people aren't clear about that. I mean, I spoke to a minister from one of the Mediterranean countries and I said, why don't you tell people that basically your solution is people have lower wages? And I can possibly say that in public. Equally, there's a sort of mirror image lie to the for the German electorate, and they're just about to vote, and you know that should be a really important moment, really. Where, and I think you know every European has a stake in this election. The Germans aren't being told, if you like, but having benefited from it disproportionately because they would on both sides, as it were, when the euro was kind of stable and. Seemed no one was asking questions about it. German manufacturers had this huge domestic market and they exported all over the place and they outcompeted Spanish and Italian and
other
Greek
people
manufacturers.
Were putting themselves into debt buying their stuff off.
Exactly. Giant kind of vendor purchase scheme underlies a large part of the euro project. But then equally, when the crisis started, two things happened. Firstly, their borrowing costs, they became a safe haven and their borrowing costs collapsed. So they were saving tens of billions of pounds. And secondly, the value of the euro was kept lower, even though Germany was a safe haven. So their exports were disproportionately cheaper to the rest of the world. So it's kind of win-win. They have benefited. And I guess the point is that they're going to have to, when pushers come to shove, they've got their checkbook out or they've got a promise of a check out to underpin the stability of the euro. And I think the check will have to be signed very soon after the German election. And you kind of think if you're a German, you'd probably want to know that before the election. But there's no clarity on that. They perhaps won't get a mandate. There's a risk that there'll be a kind of, that there'll be a bit of kind of collateral damage or that the German public might feel slightly hard done by in this not being made very clear before the election. So, you know, it works both ways. And you kind of think in order to get this system stable, they're going to have to be honest in both directions.
Sure. Okay, I want to move you on a little bit because part of what your book very interestingly does is take snapshots from different facets and aspects of what became a crisis of many dimensions. And we've just talked at length about one of them, which was Greece, the Eurozone, Germany's role. Meanwhile, though, offshore, as it were, Britain had its own problems. And they were, of course, not unrelated because London's, along with New York, biggest financial centre in the world. When the banking crisis came, it was going to hit Britain hard, and it certainly did. Now, perhaps my favourite quote of the book, so I'm going to read it out, but it comes from Nick Clegg, and it was in 1st of May 2010, so this is just 5 days before the general election, which finished with him going into government as Deputy Prime Minister. And he's commenting on the austerity package, basically, that the Conservative Party was putting up as its solution to the crisis.
It's the in-year cuts. It's the first year of cuts, £6 billion of cuts. Yeah. That's what he's talking about.
Yeah. So Clegg refers to his son, Antonio, saying, "My eight-year-old son ought to be able to work this out. You shouldn't start slamming on the brakes when the economy is barely growing. You create more joblessness and the deficit goes up even further. So it's completely irrational." And of course, in government, Clegg chose to be completely irrational, and all everything that he described there actually has happened. Was there anything other, do you think, than a purely political motive to do with getting into power that persuaded Nick Clegg that austerity was the option, was the answer, sorry?
Well, I think that very specifically, they would now say that the quantum of the cuts involved just in that first year, these were the in-year cuts, it was £6 billion.
Yeah.
It's not huge in a 1.5
It was a symbolic moment
trillion
as much pound. As
it was a down payment to the markets showing the government was serious. And he has argued since that it was the, I think it's the belly up crisis in Greece, as he called it, made it necessary to make that payment in a way that he hadn't thought a week earlier. There's been a
do you buy that as a weak transition, weak long?
Well, I mean, what's interesting about that is that you can see that argument right at the beginning. You can see that argument in 2010, but then the facts on the ground change over the past two or three years. You know, does it still hold 3 or 4 years, you know, 2 or 3 years later when the growth in the economy hadn't been so impressive? I think at the end of the day, George Osborne, and there's an account of some of these negotiations, mm-hmm. was extremely hardline on demanding total autonomy on economic policy as a condition of the talks. It was the only condition. And the Lib Dems paid that price for the talks. He was not going to compromise one bit on economic policy. Mm. And the Lib Dems felt, well, we didn't win the election.
So if they wanted to be in power, then
they had to go along with it. I mean, if you tot up the maths, there's probably a majority of MPs who were elected on the basis of there not being in year cuts. Yeah, it's probably just under, but there's certainly a lot more MPs who were elected with that. I mean, it goes further than that. I think in Andrew Adonis's book, it says that the Lib Dems then made that a condition in their brief talks with Labour.
They did. Yeah, they were suddenly became fanatical
there's
converts.
Nothing like the zeal of the convert. Yeah, exactly. Is there? I think they were. They do argue actually, and actually they do argue that it was the essentially the Eurozone crisis that has held back the economy rather than austerity. And I would say this, is that the small signs of recovery that we're beginning to see now, I mean, the most important political decision that has contributed to what we're seeing right now, and I won't overstate it, is a combination of what Mario Draghi did in Frankfurt in saying he did in London, whatever it takes. And then he hadn't cleared that with his own staff and he hadn't cleared that with governments. And then in the month that followed, Angela Merkel said, yes, you can do that. And there's some technical detail behind that. But that confidence coming from that decision and the idea that Merkel said okay to what the ECB were doing, that has created the vat of confidence that has even begun to enable the UK economy to grow again, which obviously begins to show just how interconnected everything is. I don't think there's many people in Britain, particularly given the current atmosphere as regards Europe, who would think that their jobs, livelihoods, house prices are so connected to a mysterious speech held at a UK TI investment conference around the Olympics by an Italian in charge of a kind of giant European quango. But
yeah.
But there you go.
A lot of people said that this complex, interconnected crisis that suddenly burst over us all in 2008 was a moment of opportunity for the left, because it would seem to have been a quintessential crisis of capitalism, a crisis of financial capitalism. clearly something had been going on. Clearly people had been constructing dodgy packets, dodgy deals, credit default swaps, so on. All that kind of went up in smoke, or very nearly did. What a great time for the left to say we need a different kind of way of running the economy. Now, other than, you know, we've seen the indignados in Madrid, we've seen Occupy in New York, we've seen demos in Athens, but at no stage politically do we seem to have seen critical mass arrived at for the left politically in this crisis. Why do you think that's the case?
You know, it's very tempting to kind of paint very grand narratives about kind of capitalism falling over and the rebellion, incipient rebellion about to win. I think it's the absolute opposite of the case. If you think about what's happening in the Eurozone and what's happened in Britain, what's been basically accepted by public sector workers, what's been accepted by private sector workers in cuts to wages, cuts to terms and conditions, I'm flabbergasted that the protests aren't even bigger. And even in the Eurozone, where we painted this picture of, everybody ready to riot. I mean, it's just, we haven't reached a stage where it's compared, you know, it's incomparable to, say, what happened in Argentina, where, you know, the great mass of middle Argentina came out with pots and pans, banged them, brought down governments. You know, in each of these countries, a centre-right government that is more sympathetic to cutting real wages and cutting back on the public sector, at least marginally, has been re-elected during the past years. It probably comes back to political economy and what we want governments to do. And, I mean, clearly Labour is seen by the electorate here as being the steward, having been the steward of the economy, not in an ideological sense, but in a pure managerial sense, so at a time when it fell over.
So it's paying the price of incumbency.
This is where the left-right split gets really quite interesting. Because if you look at places like Canada, where it was a centre-right government, Labour's, since 97, Labour's desire and wish to triangulate in order to kind of market itself as not a bunch of trots obviously resulted in the embrace of various questionable kind of private sector financial deals. So the private finance initiative, lack of regulation of the banking system, all that type of stuff. They were clearly trying to prove to everyone. They managed to get themselves in a position, the Labour Party, where not prudentially regulating the banking system was something that they felt they needed to do in order to be not seen as trots. That is insane, right? In Canada, it was a Conservative government that prudentially regulated the Canadian banking system that meant not a single penny of Canadian taxpayers' money was used for Canada's banks. So I think it's this bizarre thing with the marketing of British politics where you have to be seen to do the opposite of what people perceive you to be. It creates kind of bizarre incentive structures, and people don't know. So you've got this kind of bizarre dance where everyone's trying to kind of cross-dress and pretend that they're something that they're not. So I think that is an issue. And I would say that one of the problems for the Labour Party, as I see it, with an economics lens, is that they haven't really had a catharsis of what went wrong. You've heard some sort of discussions about how, oh, if only we'd regulated finance a bit more. It goes much further than that. You know, we had an economy kind of addled in financial services, real estate, and credit. We have, there's a graph that I describe in the book that will be up on the website, which shows how house prices trebled in the Labour years, whereas in Germany, real house prices, whereas in Germany, they fell by about 5 or 10% at the same time. Really? Mm. And you start to think, well, who did better out of that? You know, what? Who has the better more, society?
The more sustainable
society. Well, I tweeted it out. I wonder if Labour MPs are even thinking about whether this is a good or a bad thing. They weren't thinking about it at the time, but perhaps they should. You know, it's the sort of thing, you know, it's easy to get seduced by, if you like, the perceived wisdom. Whereas the challenges facing the country and Europe, I think, when you travel the world, and anyone that's worked anywhere else in the world will surely see that there's a lot more longer-term thinking going on. There's a bit more strategy. You don't have to be a kind of French-style dirigiste, micro-planning everything, but a little modicum of kind of where the job's going to come from. You know, hang on, we have a real crisis with young men and employment in Britain. The way in which we provide skills to these guys isn't working. Where does that leave? Where does that leave Britain in 10, 15 years? I do worry. I worry about these things.
If we could, we're running out of time, but if we could just move on to that as the last question, really, because I was very struck by one phrase that you use in the book, which I wrote down. You say there's been a generational shafting of the young of epic proportions during these 5-6 years of crisis. We all know the levels of unemployment in places like, youth unemployment in places like Spain and Italy. You know, we're talking over 50%, extraordinary levels. Here in Britain, you know, with the talk of zero contracts is shaming, really. It would seem that we have a generation of young people who are growing up unable to get a full-time job, many of them certainly unable to buy a home or even think about it in the near future. How do you think this generation in power of politicians, but not only politicians, also businessmen and so on, how can the generation that holds the levers of power make sure that there is something other than an utterly grim future for people under 25 at the moment?
Well, I think they're going to have to think of a way to deal with this. The first thing is what I would say, because otherwise they're going to leave. I don't know if, you know, I speak to people of sort of younger cousins' generations, and they are beginning to leave, because if you like the return, you know, the life that they, this is a generation who are now conditioned to expect basically lower living standards than their parents. I mean, this is a profound failing of a society that, you know, not, you know, when you don't even have to take into account housing costs. But when you then take into account housing costs against wages, even against the opportunity of a job, it can be nothing, no more serious matter than to make sure opportunities are available for young people. I think that there's a growing anger about housing, and a lot of the book is taken up with describing the very dysfunctional relationship that Britain has with property. You see it around the world too, but it's particularly acute in Britain. And it's not like people weren't warned about this. You know, I know that the Bank of England, for example, would say in private, you know, why aren't young people rebelling more about the fact that a trebling of house prices? No one's really getting it. Society has not gained net from that. That's just transferred money from old and asset rich to young and asset poor. And you most keenly see this, obviously, in the planning system, in the pension system. It's very difficult decisions that have been made on austerity. And you see, for example, argument, you know, if you think about the allocative decisions that are made in the austerity plans, they've cut things like educational allowances because there's a deadweight loss. Yet they've kept various passes and allowances, even for the richest of pensioners,
where there's for the old,
clearly a deadweight loss. If you see the pension system, you know, the public pensions crisis that exists, that the government tried to deal with, the public sector pensions crisis, that is about paying for the pensions of the rump of baby boomers who are getting older now. So essentially, younger people are being told, you will pay more now in order to guarantee conditions of public sector workers. But by the way, you will never get those conditions. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, you need to renege on all the promises that have been made, but I don't see how that's fair. A Treasury minister once told me, my dad never had a final salary pension. My son will never have a final salary pension, but I've got one. And you start to think, about the structure of the tax system, about paying for an ageing society. Very tough decisions ahead of us as a country, I think, about who pays for that. And with a wave of graduates already in huge debt to pay for their own education, seemingly never like, I mean, how on earth are these guys? These guys aren't going to get on the housing ladder. They just basically, the housing ladder is broken. Housing ladder is broken. I think we need to accept that. It's very difficult for the government to admit it because they are very committed to the property-owning democracy idea. But I think it's basically over. unless you have a rich parent. That is what I mean by generational shafting. You can do all you can to make sure a kid from a tough estate in Manchester can get to the best universities and even get a top job. And guess what? They aren't going to have the outcome of a house, or they'll be outcompeted by somebody buying a series of buy-to-lets, or they'll be outcompeted by a guy with a rich parent. And you sort of think every bit of work that's been done to try and create a kind of more meritocratic society is being undone by the housing market.
And the inequalities are returning, partly through that and partly...
Well, it's kind of rentier capitalism. It's kind of partly... it's kind of quasi-feudal, really. I wouldn't want to overstate that, but no one's going to be sent back with a hose to the fields just yet. But I think when you think about how much political capital is invested in the idea of, you know, the generational fairness of keeping the environment clean, or the national debt, this is a great generational inequity that, you know, you bequeath future debts. But then we don't actually begin to make kind of very basic planning, bearing in mind that every other country in the world is making serious plans for the economy. I kind of think, yeah, people are being failed, and I worry. And I speak as a prospective near parent, so...
right, so a growing so sense of urgency.
Well, yeah. No, it does, yeah, it matters hugely, I think.
Faisal Islam there, speaking to The Observer's Julian Komen. And Faisal's book, The Default Line, is available next week from The Guardian Bookshop. But that's it. The producer of Politics Weekly is Phil Maynard. I'm Hugh Muir. Goodbye.